Welcome to the She Negotiates podcast, where we help you claim your value, earn your worth, and smash glass ceilings. Each episode will feature an in-depth interview with an expert on how to negotiate with your doctor, your employer, your children's school, and of course, your family. Tune in to hear great stories and get actionable advice with your host, Victoria Pinchon.
Rachel Arkell, welcome to the She Negotiates podcast. How are you this morning?
Hi, Vicky. I'm well, thank you. It's actually 4 p.m. where I am in Canterbury in England. So good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. So it's a good time for both of us. So I want to first introduce my audience to you, and then I'd like you to give us just an executive summary of, you know, not only where you're at and what you're doing, but how you got there. Okay. And then I have some questions to ask you, which really cross two just burning topics today. One of them is your subject matter, and that is the monitoring of women during pregnancy. And the other one, of course, here in the United States right now is abortion, both of which fall under the general topic of the regulation by the state of women's bodies. So, but your expertise is while they're pregnant and waiting to give birth, and the issue raging in America today is, of course, abortion, which we're not going to address directly, but I think that our discussion is going to cover women's bodily integrity, and it's all about that for on both issues. So why do we have Rachel here this morning? We have Rachel here this morning because she is, and this is going to be, this description is going to be rather academic because I pulled it from the internet, and Rachel is going to make it more colloquial for us. Rachel is a qualitative researcher. She already has a master's degree in law, in medical law and ethics, and also methods of social research. She has what we used to in America call an LLB, which is a law degree. We now call it a JD because lawyers in America decided they wanted to up their prestige. But it's the same degree. And she has that from the University of Kent. Her current research, she's working on her PhD. Her current research focuses on social and policy regulation of behavior of women during pregnancy, especially concerning what they consume, what they're allowed to consume, what it's recommended they consume, both by way of liquids and what do you call non-liquid food and food? Rachel is currently funded by an agency that pursues socio-legal issues, and she's still at the University of Kent working on her PhD, exploring the communication of risk with regards to medication use during pregnancy. And current projects also include a legal and ethical analysis of the use of biomarkers to establish prenatal alcohol exposure. So, Rachel, break that down to us in English, will you?
Yes, absolutely. You are quite right. It's a very academic bio I've got at the moment. So, yep. So my background is primarily in law. As you mentioned, I did my undergrad and postgrad degree in law and medical ethics primarily. I have, as you mentioned, I'm working on my PhD, which looks at the regulation of medication during pregnancy, and any tensions that physicians might feel in the communication and disclosure of risk. So risk to the fetus, risk to the pregnant person is the core of what I'm looking at. in terms of the work that I do surrounding alcohol consumption during pregnancy, I work for the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. It's a reproductive healthcare charity primarily. So we are the largest abortion provider, independent abortion provider in the UK. We get commissioned to provide pregnancy counselling, abortion care, miscarriage management, contraceptive services, and STI testing. And we see around 100,000 women each year in our clinics across England, Wales, and Scotland. Wow. And owing to the COVID-19 pandemic, we launched a very comprehensive, robust telemedical service, which has really increased a lot of abortion accessibility to our patients. Which is fantastic and very needed during the pandemic. So the work that I do for BPAS, as you mentioned, tends to focus on the policy and social regulation that we're seeing, particularly around maternal behaviour and maternal consumption during pregnancy, and the sort of policy responses that we're getting, and basically pushing back a bit, because what we have is an emerging framework that really surveils and controls women's behavior that may not really be rooted in a lot of robust evidence.
Okay.
I think
so. Interesting. I always think when I think about the regulation of women's behavior, I often think of the scene in the movie Hairspray with women in the 1950s, very visibly pregnant women in the 1950s, sitting at a bar drinking cocktails and smoking cigarettes, which is which would be horribly wrong today.
Yeah.
But you're talking about the government forcing physicians to ask women if they have consumed any alcohol whatsoever, a sip.
Yes.
And during the course of their pregnancy, to put that in what I understand is a permanent record, and what I also understand is going to be in the child's permanent record.
Yes.
So I also understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that the women who are asked this information are not told why it's being asked and are not told it's going to be a part of both their permanent health record and the permanent health record of their child. Is that right?
Well, that's yet to be seen, actually. So
okay.
I can take you through the story of what we've got going on in the UK.
Okay, good. Bit.
So essentially, we're seeing the emergence of a policy framework which seeks to record and store this alcohol information, as you mentioned. So this is really, really novel. It's not recommended by the UK National Screening Committee. And it's something that has been pushed primarily by patient advocacy groups, which is completely understandable because we know that alcohol does cause harm in pregnancy at high levels. But what we don't know is the causal relationship between low-level consumption and harm. So instead, what the UK government did in 2016 was introduce a precautionary approach to their guidance, basically admitting that we don't know the causal relationship. So the safest option is to refrain from drinking at all during pregnancy. And so on the one hand, you've got this public health message, which is very wide by nature, and it makes sense. But now what we're seeing since 2019 is the introduction of policy that acts on that precautionary message to introduce a surveillance system. And the documents that have been published fail to grapple with any social, ethical, or legal implications that might have for women and their families. And that's what I see as the biggest issue, is that you have these really, really laudable aims. You know, we want to make sure that children and adults that have been really impacted by alcohol use in pregnancy can access support and care that they need. However, we can't ignore fundamental rights to medical confidentiality, to privacy, to medical decision-making, just because someone is pregnant. And that's the sort of tension that we're seeing in the policy framework as it emerges.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that excessive consumption of alcohol for all genders leads to domestic violence, leads to gun violence. Presumably, those kinds of social dangers, although they, I would imagine, are nearly as acute as the effects of drinking during pregnancy, are not being pursued by the UK government, correct?
Correct to some extent. I think.
Oh, really?
I think what's interesting about the debate around alcohol and pregnancy is that it really, it goes, well, it follows the push that we're seeing around ensuring preconception health, that there's this idea that there is a huge amount of pressure on women and families to create the most perfect situation, perfect circumstances in which to conceive and have a baby. But pregnancy is full of risk and full of uncertainties. And it's another example of how people are expected to sort of do everything in their power to create this perfect situation in which to conceive and control all risks, even though that's tantamount to impossible. So I'd say that the alcohol and pregnancy debate falls into that category of public discourse of creating this perfect situation in which to conceive and governing who is fit to be a parent, as opposed to the emphasis being on the dangers of alcohol. That's how I would view this situation.
I got it. I understand. Yes, I'm not going to state what I think about the UK, which is excessive consumption of alcohol in the UK is not uncommon.
No, it's definitely a thing. It's definitely a thing. We're currently in what we call Freshers Week at universities this week. So it's everyone's first week on campus. You know, you'll see plenty of drinking to excess this week, especially.
Okay, so that slight diss on the UK, it's certainly also true here in the United States. So my background is British, so I relate. Mm-hmm. I relate. Let's talk briefly about the benefits, if any, to the woman and child once there's been some identification of both as the child being eventually affected, the health of the child being eventually affected by the mother's consumption of alcohol, and any way in which that consumption of alcohol during pregnancy might harm the woman's health, so that perhaps the NHS, the National Health Service, might jump in and provide some supportive services. Is that part of the plan?
Yeah, so that's where the big push for the recording of alcohol information comes from. The top line, I'll phrase it as top line. The top line is that recording this information will lead to an earlier diagnosis. That you can only have a diagnosis of FASD, so fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or any disorders that fall under that umbrella category. You can only have a diagnosis if you have confirmed alcohol exposure recorded. And so that really becomes the gateway to support and services. Without that information, people fall through the cracks of the system and they are not adequately helped. And we repeatedly hear that an earlier diagnosis leads to better outcomes, that it leads to less secondary disabilities or adverse effects. And so that's really the central aim of these proposals and this policy framework. I'm not too sure about the figures in America, but in the UK, a large proportion of children that are in the social care system are thought to have been impacted by alcohol use during pregnancy. And so in those situations, these children may not have access to their birth mother's alcohol information. So that becomes another driving force of to why this information should be recorded.
Okay, and with whom is this information shared?
Again, we don't really know just yet. So the proposals are very vague. So they state that the alcohol information should be recorded routinely throughout pregnancy. So at the first contact and any subsequent contact a person has with the midwifery services. And that information will get recorded on their health record and then subsequently transferred to the child's health record, which would be viewed by health visitors, doctors, social care services, for example. There has been push by some stakeholders that this information should be shared even wider. However, I don't really know how successful NICE, which is the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, they're the ones that have created this proposal that I'm sort of talking about. I don't think that would be within their remit to advocate for sharing elsewhere. But the intention is that this information will be recorded and shared and could be accessed to a wide range of professionals. So on the one hand, you do have this benefit that it would lead to an earlier diagnosis, but the problem is that the policy glosses over the key causal issue. So we still don't know, as I mentioned, we don't know at what point harm happens. So we don't know the relationship between low-level consumption and harm. And so when we're recording that information, we could be attributing any neurodivergence on nominal amounts of alcohol that hasn't been backed up by the available evidence. So there's a big jump going on in the policy.
So there's a chance, I'm assuming, that children with either behavioral disorders or just behaving like five-year-olds tend to behave might be misdiagnosed as having fetal alcohol syndrome and perhaps other potential causes of what goes beyond misbehavior and becomes some sort of mental health problem will be ignored. Is that part of the concern?
Well, that's part of my concern, is that by recording any amount of alcohol, so the proposals remove a lower threshold under which the level of consumption cannot be used for diagnostic purposes. So I realize this sounds really technical. In Canada, they have national guidance on FASD. And in their guidance, they state, you know, there's a threshold that has been associated with harm. So any amount of alcohol that falls below that threshold won't be recorded for diagnostic purposes.
And what is that threshold in Canada? Do you know?
I don't know offhand. I should probably know that. But there is a lower threshold. That's the point. But in the UK, we've gotten rid of that threshold completely to make consistent with the precautionary approach that the safest response is not to drink at all. So we would be recording alcohol information which cannot be that hasn't been attributed to harm yet by the evidence, if that makes any sense.
And I had a client once who was injured, and I didn't do very much personal injury work as a lawyer, but this was kind of a friend of a friend. And so I was kind of shepherding it along until she found an attorney. And I had a record of her medical records. And in her medical records, she had divulged that she drank 2 6-packs of beer a day. And I thought, is she nuts? Why would you tell? Why would anyone tell a physician that they were drinking 2 6-packs of beer a day? And so I wonder what your experience is or what the statistics might be of women accurately describing either drug use or alcohol consumption to physicians mm-hmm. that would make this information that's going to burden both people's medical records. But what are the chances that they're actually going to divulge this? I, for instance, would likely not say, you know, I went to a wedding, we toasted with champagne. That's the only alcohol I mm-hmm. ingested. Mm-hmm. And suddenly on my record and my child's records is going to be this possibility of fetal alcohol syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really interesting question. And I think where the conversation is at in the UK is that self-reporting is inherently unreliable. So there's yeah. this idea that, as you said, if you're drinking to excess or drinking anything under this new guidance, you just wouldn't disclose that information, which is a problem that policymakers and researchers are trying to grapple with. And so there is a push to develop objective measures that don't rely on people self-reporting. But you see that repeatedly in the literature that women and pregnant people will underreport their consumption if asked during pregnancy. So in my mind, what we need to do is to foster trusting relationships between patients and healthcare professionals. And to do that well, I don't know if a surveillance system is likely to help. If anything, I think if people knew that they were going to be asked about their alcohol consumption at every appointment, you know, are they going to engage in a trusting relationship with their healthcare providers? I don't think so.
Right. Or are they going to feel like they're being surveilled?
Yeah.
Yeah. Feeling like, and are they told at that time, listen, the reason I'm asking this is because it's going to be part of your medical record and your child's medical record?
I don't know. Again, these proposals are missing a lot of information about that. So the way that I would view this is that an alcohol questionnaire is a screening tool, and everyone has the right to refuse treatment or refuse intervention. And part of the consenting process to any form of medical intervention is receiving an adequate information provision. So with something like an alcohol screen, before anyone is asked any questions about their consumption, they should be told why they're being asked this information, how that information will be stored, how it will be used, and then they can decide whether or not to partake in that screen. And that's where the presentation of the screen really comes into focus, because it's such an emotive topic that we see this with carbon monoxide screening for smoking, for example. So in the UK, a decision was made in 2010 to use carbon monoxide monitoring, so a breathalyzer, at every single antenatal appointment. And there have been studies on how that screen is delivered. And in a lot of cases, so there's this one really brilliant article where the author recounts how this screen is presented, and pregnant women are shown a dummy of a baby and an umbilical cord, and the medical professional will squeeze the cord in front of the pregnant person and say, this is what happens every time someone smokes a cigarette. You know, you're cutting off the oxygen. And then asked about their smoking status. So that's where, you know, the presentation of these screens really come into play.
Can a woman refuse to take this breathalyzer test?
They can, but is their consent being voluntarily given when that information is being presented in that way? You know, will women feel pressured to take this test because of the emotive way that it's presented? And it becomes really tricky to sort of marry together this desire to collect this information and actually having respect for people's choices, which doesn't seem like it should be much of an issue, but that's what we're seeing over in the UK with the policy.
So I have to say that that is shocking to me. If I walked into a doctor's office and for any reason they told me they wanted to give me a breathalyzer test, mm-hmm. I would walk out, yeah. Because that would destroy my trust in the physician. The physician would seem like an agent of the state. I'd think Stasi.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what we, so at BPAS, we're just finishing up a large scale research project called Risk with a W. And it's all about this communication of risk during pregnancy. And my colleague spoke to many, many women and pregnant people about their experiences. And in reflecting on the use of things like breathalyzers, it completely undermines that relationship of trust. You know, it's sort of being viewed as a lie detector, basically.
Yeah.
That you can disclose anything about your alcohol consumption. Well, not alcohol consumption in this situation, but you would disclose information about your smoking status, but then it's confirmed or not confirmed by a breathalyzer anyway. So what's the point? You know, it embeds that inherent mistrust of women to make good decisions or tell the truth about their behaviors during pregnancy.
So I'm certain that there are statistics, and it's not within your remit to know what they would be, but that smoking not only causes, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths a year, but it also causes the deaths of non-smokers from secondhand smoke. It's particularly pernicious in a household with a child. Yep. So again, I come back to the question, are they offering these breathalyzer tests to expectant fathers?
I don't think so, no. No.
Are there any similar kind of verification tests for the use of alcohol or other substances that might impact the life and the well-being of parents and children that the government has decided that they're going to require physicians to verify, for instance, when they say, you know, oh, I come in, I have chest pains, and the doctor asks me, you know, are you a smoker? I say, yes. How many? You know, I say, oh, I'm a casual smoker. I have a couple of cigarettes a day. Then is the breathalyzer brought out to test the answer?
I don't actually know that. I don't know that, but I don't,
you know. I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. But if, you know, the argument would be that if we're using this for pregnant women and people, then we should be using this for everyone. And as you said, I don't think that that is the case. And so we have this distinct category. You know, we view pregnant women in a substantially different way than the wider population, and we can treat them differently, especially when it's related to their medical care.
And philosophically, why is that? Why are pregnant? You think that I should probably know the answer to this, but but I don't know it from your perspective, because you're so much deeper into this particular intrusion on a woman's relationship with her physician and the way in which we trust or distrust women's self-reports. So my question is, what is the philosophical basis for having an objective test to verify a woman's self-report but not a man's?
Personally, I think that we have designated women as being solely responsible for any fetal outcomes and a primary source of risk to pregnancies, that women themselves pose a risk to pregnancy. And I think that that is really what underpins a lot of the policy that we have currently. That on the one hand, they're positioned as solely responsible, but on the other hand, the biggest risk. And we don't really know how to mesh those two together, because it doesn't really make sense to hold someone responsible but also view them as a risk and not trust that. So I think personally viewing it, that's where the push for something objective comes in, that it takes away the question from women. There's no chance of lying. There's no chance of protecting themselves in that situation, that the truth will be there in an objective measure.
Let me ask this, because I'm trying to find not just rationales for what seems to me simply a distrust of women more than a distrust of the general population as a whole. Mm-hmm. If I come in and report this to this mandatory question about, say, my cigarette smoking, and I say a few and they give me the breathalyzer, it turns out I'm probably smoking 2 packs a day, then can the doctor refer me to smoking cessation clinics that are going to serve my need free?
Yeah. So in the UK, as part of the smoking cessation, I'm not very good at saying that word, a part of that program, if someone is shown to be smoking, they will be automatically referred to services. You can opt out on it, but it reverses that, okay, that process. So it's not something that you volunteer for. It's something that you're guided into, but you can opt out. And that's been around in the UK for a number of years now. Okay. It's that sort of automatic intervention on behavioral choices.
So there are some, so do you believe that there are some positive aspects to the way in which public policy is being developed right now about women's use of substances during pregnancy?
I think so. I think it's a fine line, basically, for me. I think it's a fine line between giving adequate information provision, enabling people to make choices that suit them and their families, but then forcing those choices on people. So again, from the risk study, we found that the majority of women we spoke to really favored the precautionary principle, that they were happy to take any measures on that basis for their pregnancy, because really the majority of people want healthy pregnancies and will do most things to ensure a healthy pregnancy. But there is a fundamental difference between allowing someone to make those decisions for themselves and then implementing a coercive policy to put it on them instead. And that's where the tension lies, I think.
So does your agency oppose the implementation of this law that, I won't even go back to the breathalyzer because that's not the topic, although it bothers me, as you can see.
Yeah. And it bothers us as well. It bothers us as well. Yeah. So from a BPAS perspective, we really oppose these policy proposals and the policy that has already come into effect elsewhere in the UK. The biggest issue that I take that is shared by BPAS is the lack of a robust balancing act. You know, that on the one hand, you do have this really strong imperative to try and help people achieve healthy pregnancies. By all means, I think that's really, really, really important. But on the other hand, people do not lose their fundamental rights by virtue of their pregnancy. And what these proposals do is sort of, you know, park those rights to the side and say, well, actually, this information is so important that we need to ignore the norms of consent, the norms of medical confidentiality, the norms of privacy in favor of recording this information. And that does not sit well with us.
And do, as you know, I spent most of my career as a litigator, so my thoughts go to lawsuits. Mm. Has anyone filed litigation attempting to stop the implementation of this law?
Not yet. So I will correct slightly that it's not a law, that we're talking about policy here. So it's things okay. that will shape clinical practice. It won't be grounded in law, but it will be grounded in policy that healthcare trusts and CCGs, so in charge of providing services, they will sort of follow those guidance and follow that policy.
Does the policy have any sanction for a physician not following the guidance? No.
There's nothing like that in the policy, which, you know, I think is a good thing. Let's not give anyone any bad ideas about when we should start sanctioning physicians.
My lips are sealed. I will never mention it again. I would say if the states thought this was a good idea, it would be enacted into law. Mm. But you have a much more seamless medical experience than we do. And so just a brief question, when these answers are recorded mm-hmm. in a person's medical records, do they become part of some kind of national medical record kind of database?
It's a very hot topic in the UK at the moment as well. So a big push towards having online records now. So again, having everyone's health records available online, not for public consumption, but just stored. And so if this information is to be recorded on health records, it will sort of feed into this larger project, I guess, of what gets stored online.
Does it go to social services?
We don't know.
Okay.
I would be entirely shocked if these records were allowed to be shared with social services.
Okay.
However, we don't know just yet.
So right now, primarily, it would be shared with physicians so that physicians could diagnose, say, fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yes. So shared to a child's health record for future diagnostic purposes.
And does BPAS see any effect on a woman as having been kind of identified as a drinker?
Yeah. So I think, from our viewpoint, it thwarts any attempt for that woman to form a trusting relationship with her midwife or healthcare professional. You know, this person is meant to, you know, midwife literally means with woman. This person is meant to look after her throughout her pregnancy. And if she cannot confide to her midwife about any issues that she might be having with substance use, consumption, alcohol consumption, anything like that, without the fear that this information won't stay confidential, you might be cutting her off to access to support that she would quite like or would need in that situation.
So do you have does BPAS have an alternative? I didn't ask you, and I want to ask you as we come to near the end of the interview. I understand that a woman's, I can't pronounce it, meconium. I don't know what a meconium is, but there's some suggestion there might be testing of a woman's meconium. Can you talk about that briefly?
I can talk about that briefly. So it wouldn't actually be a woman's meconium. So for those who have children, they might know what meconium is. So essentially, it's an infant's first feces. This is the stage that we're at now in the public health conversation, that we're willing to test infant poo to see if a woman's telling the truth about her alcohol consumption. So I know that that's making light of it, but really these proposals are quite horrifying. So meconium is considered a long-term marker for alcohol consumption. So what that means is that it's considered a direct reflection of someone's alcohol consumption from the second trimester onwards. So in terms of different types of biomarkers, it beats a hair sample or a blood sample in being able to tell us whether someone has drunk during pregnancy. So what we see littered throughout these policy documents is the intention to further research into the use of meconium for establishing prenatal alcohol exposure, which again is one of these situations that hasn't been approached from any sort of ethical, legal, social standpoint to really roll back and be like, okay, so why are we doing this? And what are the implications if we roll out testing that looks like this? In my mind, any sort of journey into objective measures is just used as a way to bypass asking women because we actually don't trust them to tell the truth. And that's where the push, I think, comes from to develop such testing.
So Des, is it BPAS's position that any objective testing to determine whether or not the woman is telling the truth about her usage of substances during her pregnancy, does BPAS oppose it, or does it have an alternative proposal?
I think the alternative proposal would be to trust women, to trust people to tell the truth. You know, so much of our work and our ethos as an organization is trusting people to make the right decisions for themselves, especially around pregnancy and reproduction, whether that's having a pregnancy, ending a pregnancy. We trust people to make, they're the best people to make decisions, you know, it's decisions for themselves. And so in approaching the topic of objective measures that would be used in that situation to bypass self-reporting around substance use, alcohol, anything during pregnancy, I think it goes against what we stand for.
It's. I was thinking about this last night as I was falling asleep, believe it or not. And I was thinking that, you know, one of the problems with current medicine and something that we have historically lost is the family physician, is the person who I, for instance, have had the same doctor since 1984, who I adore because he can say, I can say, I broke my toe again. Is, you know, are my bones fragile now that I'm aging? And he says, you are accident prone, Vicky. And because he knows, you know, he knows me. Yeah. He knows me to administer, to make a decision whether or not he's going to give me an anxiety reducing drug. And if he does so, what that anxiety reducing drug might be. Mm. And what I'm seeing now are, especially in the United States, are, attempts to force physicians to test for, not to test for opiate use, but to review people's records in which they've used opiates and then give them a score, and that score enters their medical record, and then the doctor is required to refuse to give that person pain medication, even if they're undergoing, you know, cancer treatment or they've had a catastrophic accident, because the physician can be subjected to potentially the loss of his license for prescribing pain medication to someone who, for instance, is seen to have asked too many different doctors for opiates, which is a sign that someone is drug seeking. But in the case reported that I read a couple of days ago, the woman had been getting opiate treatment for a pet, and had seen many different and the prescription was under her name, and so she had some kind of catastrophic injury, and she couldn't get an opiate prescription. In fact, the hospital stopped giving her intravenous opiates because they decided she was an addict. That troubled me. So it seems as if an alternative might be, and I don't know how National Health Service works, but to make sure there's some continuity in medical treatment so that a doctor could know a patient at 5 and 15 and 25 and 35 and have some kind of sense of who they are so that they can prescribe for the person who they know. What is the NHS what's the paradigm for NHS treatment by a primary care physician?
That's a big old question. the way it sort of works, or my experience of it, is that your primary care physician doesn't follow you. So you know, if someone moves across the country or moves to a different city, you know, that there isn't that continuity of care by one specific physician. You know, there will be a continuity of medical records that follows you around everywhere. But yeah, we don't have that sort of, we don't have that provision of having one sort of primary caregiver that follows you around.
I suppose a lot of that is just due to changes in the ways in which people move.
Yeah.
Which they didn't when I was a child.
Yeah.
I have been in Los Angeles since 1984, and so I've been blessed but with the same physician since that time. And that's very reassuring to me.
Yeah.
That the physician is prescribing based on a history that the physician knows, as opposed to a cold medical record.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can see why that would be reassuring. I'm a bit jealous of that, actually.
So at the end of the day, what is your greatest hope for the treatment of pregnant women from conception to birth by the medical system?
So I think my biggest hope would be that women's interests are better protected when it comes to questions about substance use or things that might pose a risk to the fetus. I think that we need to remember and really protect women and pregnant people's autonomy and bodily integrity, and that we need to constantly remind ourselves and everyone else that you do not lose these things by virtue of pregnancy, and that actually it should be a fundamental part of medical care. And I think that somewhere along the way with these policy documents, that's just getting lost. And so it would be my hope that we can really come back with a firm stance on bodily integrity and respect for people going forward.
Okay, good. And your work, what is your PhD work? I'm not going to ask you when it's going to be completed, because that's a terrible thing to ask a PhD candidate.
Yeah, but that's a very mean question.
That's a very mean question. So what is the very narrow issue I assume that you're addressing in your PhD work?
So I am looking at medication that could be potentially life-saving for women. So I'm looking at seizure control medication, primarily used for epilepsy, that could cause a risk of harm to the fetus. So looking at how physicians are able to balance legal standards of informed consent and disclosure of risk with really strict forms of drug regulation, like pregnancy prevention programs, and how physicians navigate that. That's the central core of my thesis. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's a fairly new podcast, so we're, trying to invite luminaries, and you are one in this field. I have never heard of anything that you're doing before, and I expect to hear a lot about it in the future, because I do read The Guardian and The Telegraph, so I have some knowledge about what's happening in the UK. Yeah. And of course, I follow women's rights. Mm-hmm. So would you like people to reach you? How do people find out where you are and what your research, where your research is located?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter. I will do a Twitter handle shout out, which would be r_Arkel, which is my surname, on Twitter. And we do have a new account for our new research center at BPAS, so the Center for Reproductive Research and Communication, where we are hoping to continue this sort of mission of ensuring women have access to good evidence base to make their decisions.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Rachel. Have a, you know, thank best you. Luck with your research and with having an effect that respects women's autonomy and integrity.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of She Negotiates. If you liked it, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, remember, the world needs what you have to offer. All you have to do is ask.